Two numbers, same quarter. Australian startups announced $1.7 billion of funding between April and June this year. That's up 60% on the same quarter last year.
Sounds like a good quarter.
In the same 3 months, 31 rounds under $5 million were announced. 31. That's the lowest number since anyone started counting back in 2020.
And that's the number I actually lose sleep over.
The money is back. It's just not arriving where most founders are standing. That's what this episode is about. Recorded in Sydney, 33 degrees, 52 minutes south, this is the Founder Stack. I'm Daniel Dracopoulos. This show is about how startups get to market and how the marketing and the technology behind that actually get built. Go-to-market strategy, marketing technology, data-driven growth, the alignment between technical and commercial co-founders, and what scaling looks like after launch. We're starting where my firm's work starts, with go-to-market blueprinting, the document that sets out who a company is for, how it's positioned, which channels it'll use, and in what order. Written before the first campaign runs, not after. And the reason to start here, this year, is the funding market. It's split. Early rounds are happening. Big late rounds are back. The middle, the $5 to $20 million round that used to pay for a company's go-to-market, is thinner than it's been in years. Smart Company called it the missing middle, and the name has stuck. My guest today is a partner at a seed to Series A fund here in Australia. He sits on the investor side of the cut-through surveys, so he sees this data before the rest of us do. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. And I'll say up front, I'm going to disagree with you at least once.
I'd be disappointed if you didn't. Let's start with the numbers and then get past them. So, cut-through's first quarter report. $1.8 billion across 81 venture rounds and 26 accelerator rounds. Strongest first quarter since 2022. Then the second quarter, $1.7 billion across 64 venture rounds. Call it $3.5 billion for the half. Underneath that, two things. The small rounds, 31 under $5 million in the June quarter, a record low. And concentration. Forbes Australia worked out that about 70% of the quarter's venture cash went into two companies. You see this from the inside. When you look at those two reports, what's signal and what's noise?
The total is noise. I'll be blunt about that. When two rounds make up 70% of the quarter, the headline number tells you about two companies. It tells you nothing about the other 60-odd.
So the count is the signal.
The count is the signal. 31 small rounds is the pipeline. That's the number of companies who'll be walking into my office in 18 months looking for the next check. If that's a record low, then in 18 months, I've got a thin pipeline, and so does everyone else.
And why is it low? Is it that fewer companies are starting, or that fewer are getting funded at that stage?
Honestly, a bit of both, but mostly the second. Funds are writing fewer, larger checks. It's easier for me to put $4 million into one company I'm confident about than $1 million into four I'm half sure of. That's rational for me. It's terrible for the ecosystem.
There was one more thing in the first quarter survey that I think matters. Investors said, pretty overwhelmingly, that AI-first startups were getting higher valuations than non-AI companies at the same stage.
Yeah, that's true, and I don't love it. It's become the lens everything is looked at through. If you walk in and you can't say the letters A and I in your first sentence, you're starting from behind, whether or not that's fair.
We'll come back to whether it's fair. I want to add that this isn't an Australian peculiarity. In Southeast Asia, technology funding more than doubled in the first half, about 7.4 billion US dollars, and Singapore took 94% of it.
94.
94. And fintech funding in the region actually fell. In the UK, London absorbs about two-thirds of venture funding, and fintech is about a quarter of it. So wherever my firm works, capital is concentrating, by geography, by sector, by stage.
which is why I keep telling founders, stop reading the headline, read the count, read the concentration. That's the market you're actually in.
Does the concentration change what the other 90-odd funded companies should be building toward? The ones who aren't the two big deals?
It should. If you're not going to be one of the two, and statistically you're not, then you need to be the kind of company that doesn't need the big round to get to the next stage, which means you need to be good at the thing the big round usually pays for.
Which is go to market.
Which is go to market. That's the irony of it. The money that used to buy a route to market has gone away. So now you have to build the route to market to attract the money. It's backwards, and it's where we are.
And the sector's getting funded from the second quarter report. AI models and data infrastructure. FinTech, hardware and robotics. If you're a plain software company with a product and some revenue, you're not on that list.
You're not. And I want to be careful here, because good companies in boring categories still get funded. But they get funded on evidence. The AI company gets funded on a story. The plain software company gets funded on cohorts. That's the difference. And it's a difference in what you need to have ready.
Let me say what I think the missing middle actually is, and you tell me if I'm wrong.
Go on.
The $5 to $20 million round had a job. A company had a product, some revenue, some evidence of demand, and the round paid for the go-to-market. The first real marketing hires, the paid channels, the sales motion, the tooling. It was, in effect, the round that bought a route to market. If that round is thinner, one of two things happens. Either the company stretches its seed money further and has to prove a route to market on less, or it has to reach the later round with the route to market already working. Either way, the go-to-market question arrives earlier and it arrives with less money attached.
That's mostly right. Here's where I push back. Some of that middle hasn't vanished. It's migrated. Seeds are bigger than they were. You see seed extensions now that would have been called a Series A 5 years ago. So the money exists, it's just labeled differently, and it arrives with different expectations.
Different how?
When I lead a round now, I want to see repeatable acquisition. Not the promise of it, actual cohorts, actual payback, a channel that works twice. That used to be Series A evidence. Now I'm asking for it at what's effectively the mid round, because that's the round I'm being asked to lead.
Which means the blueprint is no longer something you write once you've got the money to execute it.
No.
It's the thing you show to get the money.
It's the thing you show to get the money. And honestly, most founders don't have one. They have a deck with a slide called Go to Market, and it's a list of logos.
So what's the bar? I want to put some benchmarks on the table, because I think founders hear the phrase efficient growth and don't actually know what number they're being measured against.
Please, nobody tells them.
Aleph and Benchmarket published their 2026 SaaS and AI performance benchmarks in June. 342 companies, full year 2025 actuals. Median customer acquisition cost payback, 16 months. Top quartile, 6 months or fewer. Bottom quartile, 24 months or more.
Median gross revenue retention, 84%. That's down 4 points on the year. Median magic number, 1.37. Above 1 for the first time in a while. Median annual recurring revenue per employee, $193,000, up 29%. And from the wider benchmark reporting, average SaaS growth has fallen to about 18%, with roughly a third of companies shrinking year on year, while the best are still growing north of 25% on less burn. When you underwrite a company for the next round, which of those numbers do you actually use?
Payback and retention. Growth is the one everyone talks about, and it's the one I trust least, because you can buy growth, you can't buy payback.
Walk me through payback.
16 months median, Fine. If you've got 24 months of runway and a 16-month payback, you can survive that. You're not going to thrive, but you'll survive. 24-month payback on 24 months of runway, you're dead. You just don't know it yet. So I'm looking at whether a company is on the right side of that line and whether there's a credible story for getting toward the top quartile.
Do you assume they can reach the top quartile?
I assume they can move toward it. A lead investor will quietly assume you can get from 16 to, say, 10. If your plan says you'll get to 6, I'll ask you how, and the answer had better not be a bigger ad budget.
Let me press on retention, because I think it's misfiled.
Misfiled how?
84% gross retention gets called a product problem. In my experience, it's just as often a go-to-market problem. The company acquired customers it was never for. The positioning was broad enough to close them, and too broad to keep them.
Yeah, I partly agree with that. When I actually sit down with a churn analysis, it's almost never evenly spread. It's a segment. One type of customer is leaving, and the rest are fine. And that segment usually got in because the targeting was loose or the qualification was loose.
So the fix is upstream?
The fix is upstream. It's in who you go after, not in the roadmap. Though, try telling a product team that.
So the bar has two halves. Acquire efficiently, that's payback, and acquire the right people, that's retention. Neither of those is a campaign setting. Both are blueprint decisions.
Agreed. And the second one is the one founders underrate. Everyone's trying to bring payback down. Almost nobody's asking whether they're bringing in people who'll stay.
The other two figures in that data set interest me. Magic number at 1.37 and revenue per employee up 29% in a year. What are those telling you?
They're telling me the survivors got lean. Revenue per head jumping that much in 1 year isn't because everyone suddenly sold more. It's because a lot of companies cut people and kept revenue flat. Which is fine, it's necessary, but it's not growth.
And the magic number?
Above one means a dollar of sales and marketing spend is returning more than a dollar of new recurring revenue within the year. For years, it was under one across the board. So I read that as the market having stopped buying growth it couldn't afford, which I'd call healthy.
Healthy and painful.
Healthy and painful. Most healthy things are. The point for a founder listening is that those are the numbers the person across the table has in their head. 16 months, 84%, above one. If your blueprint can't talk to those three numbers, it's not finished.
And the growth figure, average 18%, a third of companies shrinking, the best above 25. What separates the best in acquisition specifically?
Focus. Honestly, it's boring. The efficient ones picked one or two channels, got them working properly, and stopped pretending the other four were about to come good. They spend less because they spend in fewer places. The ones shrinking are usually still running every channel they ever tried, at a quarter of the budget each.
Let me describe what a go-to-market blueprint actually is, the way my firm builds one, because the phrase gets used for everything from a single slide to a 100-page deck.
Usually the slide.
Usually the slide. It has four parts. Audience. Who the company is for, specifically enough that you could say who it is not for. Positioning. The claim the company makes to that audience, in their words, against the alternatives they actually consider. Channels. The two or three ways that audience can be reached, with the evidence for each. And sequence. The order in which those channels get built, and what has to be true before the next one starts. And it has some things it refuses to contain. It doesn't contain tool names, Platform selection is a later stage, and if a tool turns up in the blueprint, it's usually because someone already bought it. It doesn't contain a campaign calendar. It doesn't contain a budget line per channel. It contains the logic a budget will later follow. That's the whole document. It's short. It's written before the first campaign. And it's the first thing I ask to see in a discovery audit, because whether it exists and whether it was written before or after the campaign started tells me most of what I need to know.
How can you tell it was written afterwards?
I was about to ask you that.
Fine, okay, the tells. A channel list with no evidence, just we'll do paid social, we'll do content, we'll do outbound. No numbers next to any of it. Positioning that describes features instead of a claim. An audience that's defined entirely by company size and industry, so there's no human in it.
The absence of a not for.
The absence of a not for, yes. If you can't tell me who you'd turn away, you haven't decided who you're for.
How specific does audience need to be before you'd accept a channel decision built on it?
Specific enough that I could picture the person and guess where they spend their Tuesday. Not mid-market companies in financial services. That's a filter, not an audience. More like the operations lead at a 50-person lender who's currently doing this job in free spreadsheets and hates it. Now I know which channels might reach her and which definitely won't.
That's a good test. Could you guess where they spend their Tuesday?
And if you can't, you can't choose a channel. You're just choosing the channels you've heard of. And the big one, the plan matches the existing spend exactly. Whatever they're already doing, that's the plan. Which means it was written by looking at the bank statement.
And no sequence.
No sequence. Everything at once.
That's the one I see most. Three paid channels, content, outbound, partnerships. All live, all under-resourced, all at the same time. I'd much rather see one channel, built to the point where its unit economics are known, with the next one scheduled behind a condition. Not a date, a condition.
I'll push on that. Some markets punish you for going slow. If you're in a category with a short window and someone else is spending across five channels, one channel done beautifully might mean you lose.
That's fair. And I'd say sequence isn't slowness. It's knowing what has to be true before you add the next thing. That can be fast if the conditions get met fast. What I'm arguing against is adding the next thing because the calendar said so.
Okay, I can live with that.
One more, because it comes up in every audit this year. AI. The cut-through survey said AI-first companies get higher valuations at the same stage. So the temptation is to put it in the positioning.
Everyone does.
My view is that AI belongs in the blueprint only where it changes one of the four parts. It changes who you're for, or it changes the claim, or the channel, or the sequence. If it doesn't change any of those, it's a feature, and features don't belong in positioning.
I'd go a step further. If AI is the whole claim, I'm worried, because every competitor can make the same claim by Tuesday. The claim has to be about what it does for the audience, and AI is how, it's not what.
Every engagement my firm takes on starts with a discovery audit, a fortnight usually. And I want to say what's in it because it's the practical version of everything we've just talked about.
Go.
We look at four things. Whether a blueprint exists and when it was written. What the acquisition data actually shows, by channel, by cohort, against the benchmarks we just discussed. Whether marketing and engineering are working from one data model or two. Because if a company can't agree what a customer is between its CRM and its product database, none of the acquisition numbers are trustworthy. And what the stack is. What's been bought, what's used, what's duplicated. The audit ends in a strategy blueprint and an implementation roadmap, not a list of recommendations, a document and a sequence.
The data model one. How often is that the problem?
More often than not. Marketing's definition of a lead and engineering's definition of a user are different objects in different systems, and the reconciliation happens in a spreadsheet somebody updates on a Friday.
The Friday spreadsheet. I've seen that spreadsheet. I've been sent that spreadsheet in a data room.
And the stack question is related. What's been bought? What's used? What's duplicated? Almost every company I audit has two tools doing the same job because one person bought one and somebody else bought the other, and they both hold a slightly different version of the customer.
Which is how you end up with three definitions of a lead.
Which is how you end up with three definitions of a lead. So the audit isn't really about tools. It's about finding out whether the company has one version of the truth or several, because the blueprint has to be built on one.
How long before you know? You said a fortnight for the audit. How long before you know whether there's a route to market or just a product?
Usually the first conversation. The fortnight is for proving it to the founders in their own data, which is a different thing from knowing it.
That's very honest.
The questions that give it away are simple ones. Who's your best customer and how did they find you? If the answer to the second half is, I'm not sure, or it varies, there's a product and there isn't yet a route. If the answer is specific and the same story comes back for the next three customers I ask about, there's a route. It may be small, but it's there. From your side of the table, when a company arrives with that kind of document, a blueprint and a roadmap, does it change the conversation?
Completely. It shortens diligence for one. I'm not reverse engineering their growth engine from the numbers. They've told me what it is. And it signals something about the founders. It says they understand how their company grows, not just that it grows.
Is the roadmap or the projections more persuasive?
The roadmap, every time. Projections are a spreadsheet with a growth rate typed into it. A roadmap shows me what the money buys, in what order, and what has to be true to move to the next step. That's a plan. The other thing is a wish.
Let me turn the blueprint toward the data room. A founder's written the four-part document we described. What does a fund actually read, and what does it skip?
First thing I read is the audience definition. Is there a real person in it, or is it a firmographic? Second, channel evidence. Show me one channel with known economics and a credible second one, not five.
And payback.
I check how they compute payback. Does their CAC include salaries, include tooling, include the founder's time doing outbound? Because if it doesn't, their 6-month payback is really 14.
What do you skip?
The vision slide, the market size slide, anything with the word disrupt on it. I'm sorry, I know people work hard on those, but I don't fund a market. I fund a route into it.
Sequence?
Sequence tied to milestones, yes. Sequence tied to dates, no. If the plan says channel 2 starts in Q3, I'll ask why Q3. If it says channel 2 starts when channel 1's payback is under 12 months, that's a plan I can underwrite.
So the fund's reading for exactly the two halves of the bar: efficient acquisition, the right acquisition, and sequence.
That's it. That's the whole read.
Which is the argument for writing it first. A founder who writes the blueprint before the campaigns has something to show you that wasn't reverse engineered from the spend.
And I can tell. I can always tell. The ones written afterwards have a smell to them. Everything fits too neatly.
Last thing. The firm works across Australia, the UK, and Southeast Asia. And this comes up in nearly every conversation. Founders talk about expansion as a growth decision. We've won here. Let's go there.
Let's open a Singapore office.
Let's open a Singapore office. I think it's a blueprint decision. The audience is different. The positioning usually needs rewriting in local terms. The channels that worked in Sydney may not exist in the same form in London or Singapore. And the sequence, which market, then which, is the biggest sequencing choice a company ever makes.
And it's the one most often made on a whim. A founder meets someone at a conference, and suddenly there's a UK expansion in the deck.
What would you want to see in the blueprint before any local hire gets made in London or Singapore?
The same four things, written again for that market. Not copied, rewritten. Who's the audience there, in their terms? What's the claim against the alternatives they actually use, which won't be the same alternatives? Which channels exist there? And honestly, a reason this market is before the other one. There isn't, a friend of mine runs a fund there.
And the evidence, even a little, a handful of customers in that market who came to you without you going to them.
Yes, if nobody in London has found you on their own, that's information. Not a stop sign, but information. And the founders who skip that step are the ones I'm having a very different conversation with 12 months later.
We'll give that its own episode later in the season. But first, the question I ask everyone who sits across from me on this show. What is the one thing in your stack you would rip out tomorrow, and what would you put in its place?
Oh, that's easy. Not in my stack, in my portfolio's stacks. The reporting layer. Nearly every company I work with has some reporting tool bolted on top of everything else, and it doesn't reconcile with finance. So the board gets one number and the accountant gets another.
And in its place?
One agreed definition of a customer and a spreadsheet. Honestly, until the definitions are agreed, the tool is just making the disagreement prettier.
I couldn't have set that up better if I'd tried. That's the third episode of this season, almost word for word.
Send me the invoice.
That's the founder stack for this episode. My thanks to my guest. The summary, the reading list with every source we quoted, and the full transcript are at danieldrakopoulos.com under media. The whole archives at dracopodcast.com. The newsletter takes this episode's campaign performance thread further, and you can subscribe on the site. Next time, 15,000 tools and how to choose almost none of them. Marketing stack configuration. Alignment between creative marketing and engineering removes operational friction and accelerates product market fit. That's the show. I'm Daniel Drakopoulos.